Tonight's scripture reading comes from the book Romans chapter 2, verses 12 to 29. All who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law, and all who sin under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not those who hear the law who are righteous in God's sight, but it is those who obey the law who will be declared righteous. Indeed, when Gentiles, who do not have the law, do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them, and at other times even defending them. This will take place on the day when God judges people's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. Now you, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and boast in God, if you know his will and approve of what is superior because you are instructed by the law, if you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor for the foolish, a teacher of little children, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Circumcision has value if you observe the law, but if you break the law, you have become as though you had not been circumcised. So then, if those who are not circumcised keep the law's requirements, will they not be regarded as though they were circumcised? The one who is not circumcised physically and yet obeys the law will condemn you who, even though you have the written code and circumcision, are a lawbreaker. A person is not a Jew who is one only outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the written code. Such a person's praise is not from other people, but from God. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Redeemer's Eastside Congregation, especially if you're new, maybe if this is your first time here, I'm especially glad that you're with us. Thanks so much. We're in the middle of a sermon series this fall called Public Faith. And last Sunday, we looked at the first chapter of the New Testament book of Romans. Sermon title was Knowing God. And the idea is that God has just thrown all of these clues all over the place, inviting us to explore the possibility of belief. And this week, it's the very next chapter, Romans chapter 2. And it's a twist on the title of the sermon from last week. It's not knowing God, it's knowing good. Because the idea here is, doesn't it feel like we're built with this basic intuitive sense of right and wrong? So why is it that we feel so strongly about some things like a violation of fundamental human rights? Why are we so passionate about that? Or, you know, why are we so outraged when our own rights are violated? When, for instance, you're walking in the city and someone cuts you off walking down the street. Or something even worse, someone poaches a taxi from you. I mean, outrageous, right? Deep sense of right and wrong. This is golden rule sort of stuff. Well, but I mean, that's basically what we're talking about. And it's not simply this idea that we understand that there is this basic right and wrong to life, but it's also that we want to know good in our life, don't we? I mean, we want that first-rate life. We want the good life. No one says, you know, they want to get to the end of their life and say, boy, it's a great thing I've really lived a bad life. I mean, of course, everyone instinctively wants to live a good life. And so when we sense that we are steering off of that path that leads to the good life, we, to borrow a phrase, break bad. We want to realign ourselves to that path that leads to the good life. And so how do we do that? That's what tonight is about. It's asking this question, how is it that we can know good in the fullness of life? Let's think about it in these ways. We can know good, first of all, by knowing the foundation for good in our life. The foundation for knowing good. Secondly, the impediment for knowing good. And then finally, the secret for knowing good. So the foundation for knowing good, the impediment for knowing good, and the secret for knowing good. First of all, the foundation for knowing good. The backdrop, really, for the entire Bible, and certainly the presupposition of this particular passage, is that there is an infinitely and inherently good God, and that all goodness in the world, all human goodness, certainly, is derivative. It flows from him. And so he has built us with this basic sense. He's invented life, see, and he understands how life best operates. And so he has given to us, in essence, his instruction manual, his operating procedures for here's how life is to be operated so that you enjoy knowing good in all of life. And this is certainly true for the person who embraces the truth of the faith of Christianity or even Judaism, because he gave to us the law. And Paul talks about the law frequently throughout this passage because this is in essence God's instruction manual for how to know good in all of life. But if you're not a believer or you're really not sure of what you believe, what this passage also teaches us right up front, early on, is that he has actually embedded, this is in verse 14, more specifically in verse 15, that he has written the law on our hearts. That the essence of the written law is placed on every single human heart. See, and so that's why we understand that we are supposed to, there is an oughtness to life, isn't there? We're supposed to be good people. We're supposed to be loving people. We're supposed to care for others and have integrity in all of life. On the other hand, we know that we're not supposed to be cruel people and unjust people. We're not supposed to be self-consumed. And when we come across someone who is obviously narcissistic, it's really offensive to us. Why? Because of this basic sense of right and wrong, because the law of God, whether it's the written law, we can just say Bible from now on, whether it's the Bible or the essence of it that is etched into every human heart, it's like a moral compass, isn't it, that helps us find our way along the pathway that leads ultimately to knowing good. So the point that I want you to catch right up front here is that without God, we have no basis. We have no objective foundation to know good. Now, some of you may recoil at that and say, no, wait a minute, that's kind of arrogant for you to say that unless you believe what you believe, that you can't know good. That's absolutely ridiculous, historically speaking, because plenty of people who are non-religious, plenty of people who don't believe what I believe, have done extraordinarily good things. And the value added of their life is we benefit from that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that you have to believe what I believe to know good in that sense. The question really is, where'd you get the idea for it? Where did it come from? If, for instance, we are simply a product of naturalistic evolution, if life is simply a matter of the strong gobbling up the weak, then why is there moral outrage for things like human trafficking? Why are we so incensed by pedophiles and want to see them brought to justice? Why is it that we are troubled oftentimes by this idea, Machiavellian idea, that the end justifies the means? Now, all of us are not that convicted by that particular notion, but where does that come from? See, the idea from that comes from a God who has given to us a law that's either one we hold and read in the Bible, or it's etched on our human heart. You say, well, no, for me, I get my moral compass based on human needs, social contracts, and it's very contextually specific. But it's not that easy as well. There was a really interesting article in the Chronicle of Higher Education. A cultural anthropologist wrote an article called Cultural Relativism and Universal Rights. And she explained that as a scholar who adopted a very secular worldview, she had no basis for imposing her Western idea of universal human rights on people from non-Western cultures who practiced violence toward women, racial genocide, other things similar. On the other hand, her commitment to those causes, her passion to those causes, caused her to wrestle with this idea. And in fact, it made her, frankly, to have a deep aversion to these cultures who practice these kinds of evil, in her estimation. She went on to write this. She said, "When there is a choice between defending human rights and defending cultural relativism, anthropologists should choose to promote human rights." See, so she's faced with this ethical conundrum, and to her credit, she had the intellectual integrity to say, "Look, my worldview, that there's no basis for me imposing my kind of values upon them, but it just feels right." See, and it comes back to that sense that it's right there inside of every one of us, written on our soul, and we have to deal with it. So that when we feel evil, when we are outraged by acts of heinous wrong, then this is because we're standing, whether we realize it or not, upon a foundation of knowing good, a foundation of objective moral truth. And it is deeply part of our being. Our internal wiring is inextricably tied with this. And sometimes, I don't know if you've felt this way, of course you have, because every single one of us has a conscience. Doesn't it feel sometimes like out of that foundation emerges this hand, I'm talking about inside of you, and it comes up and then it does this, it just like, it points right at you. It's saying, I'm not talking so much about what's out there, the evil that's out there, I'm talking about what's in here. There was a movie a number of years ago called A Simple Plan, Bill Paxton and Billy Bob Thornton. And, you know, Hank, who's played by Bill Paxton, was this very, very average, intelligent, extremely conscientious person of integrity, a respectable person. And at the beginning of the movie, he's narrating it, and he says these words that later will haunt him. "I remember my father telling me what he thought it took for a man to be happy. Simple things, a wife he loves, a job he likes. And for a while there, without realizing it, I had all of that, and I was a happy man." And then the story begins to unfold. He and his dim-witted brother, Jacob, played by Billy Bob Thornton, fantastically played by him, they stumble across, out in the country, this private plane that has crashed. All of the occupants are dead, and they find in the plane some money, a lot of money, $4.4 million worth of money. And they're like, what do we do? Well, they reason, you know, this was drug money and it's not going to hurt anyone. So they take it. And then everything begins to unravel, because then it becomes a story of covering up and saving their reputation and evils that particularly Hank could never have imagined committing, even murder. He found himself committing in order to keep himself safe. And at one very chilling and poignant point, again, his dim-witted brother looks at him in the eye and says, "Hank, you ever feel evil?" It's the hand coming right up. And it's that hand that Paul is talking about in this passage when he talks about the conscience, that the conscience can both be our aid and our adversary, can't it? He says, you know, at one moment, it's advising us, it's counseling us, and at another moment, it's condemning us. At one moment, it's saying, don't do that. At another moment, it's basically helping us rationalize and excuse our behavior. And so it's incredibly slippery and difficult. What do we need? Well, we need a foundation. And we need a foundation with God as the foundation, ultimately, the source of all moral excellence and good. And with God, we have this written code, this law, the Bible. And as we know the law of God, then we come actually to know not only what it's like to know good, but we come to know ourselves, because this is how he made us. This is what it's about. Knowing good. It's about really discovering ourselves, so that when we deviate from that path, we're contradicting our true selves. And I think this is what Jesus had in mind in maybe the most famous sermon ever preached, typically called the Sermon on the Mount, where it was his own exposition of the law. And he got to the very end of it, and he summarized it with a very effective image, where he said, look, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise person who built their house upon a rock. That way, anything that comes, natural disasters, thieves, the house stands strong. And you know, that's what it's all about. It's building that good life. And we have to have a foundation upon which we do that, that is rock solid. Otherwise, the natural disasters, spiritually, psychologically, relationally, vocationally, so on and so forth, they will shake our house. And if the foundation isn't strong, we'll fall. But when we build our lives on God's law, we thrive. And everything and everyone who's tethered to us as well. So that's the first idea, that if we want to know good, we have to know that there's a foundation for knowing good. Now, what about the impediment to knowing good? Because if it were that easy, if it's that tight, then why don't we implement that more into our lives? Well, because there is a massive impediment to it, which Paul talks a great deal a bit in this passage. In fact, you don't have to go any further than the first phrase, all who sin apart from law will perish from the law. All who sin under the law will be judged by the law. Paul says the impediment to knowing good is sin. I know that some of you cringe even when I say that word, and part of it may be because of unhelpful religious experiences in your past, or maybe it just seems pre-modern. Sin? Really? Because maybe it makes you feel like, oh, well, all you're telling me now is that I'm a bad person. That's not the idea that Paul has in mind here. Sin really is talking about misalignment. You know, we were made to be aligned with his design for our life. Again, that's captured in the Bible. And when that doesn't happen, there's a misalignment and things just don't work the way that they're supposed to. It's dishonoring certainly to the designer of the product because that's how he made the product to function, our lives and the world. It's like we're trying to run the train of our lives off the tracks of his will, and that just leads to destruction. And this applies to both religious and non-religious people. So that's why he says, look, if you sin apart from the law, you're not exempt, you're not off the hook, because, again, that law, the essence of it, is etched into every human heart. There's a universal awareness and accountability. But the interesting thing that I want you to notice is he really doesn't spend so much time talking to the non-religious person. He really pushes this down on those of us who say we're believers, who say we believe this. And he pushes it down in some pretty interesting ways. He pinpoints how incongruent it oftentimes is what people say and what's really going on inside, or even their expectations of external moral behavior by themselves and by other people, and what's really going on in the subterranean world of their self. So for instance, in verse 17, he says, look, you rely on the law and boast in God and act superior to others about it. Convinced you are a guide for the blind, a light for those in the dark. But then you go on and do the same things. He's talking about a morally uptight person. So actually, you don't have to be, for this to speak to you, you don't have to be a convinced believer. You could just be a really morally conservative, conscientious, uptight person. And what we do is we develop this exterior and typically ignore what's going on inside. The irony of all this, tragic irony, he says in verse 24, is that God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles. What does he mean by that? Gentiles just means people who don't believe this, non-believers, non-religious people. And blasphemed means you're making a mockery of your God. The irony there, because when you think, okay, I'm a morally upstanding person. I'm a strong religious person. And you think that ought to be a commendation to your God. And they're saying, no, people can read right through your hypocrisy. See, you've not only looked like a fool, played the part of a fool before these people, but you've made your God look foolish as well. How dare you do that? Now, you say, well, what does he mean by we basically do the same things? Well, he goes through a litany of things. You know, you who presume to be a teacher. Uh-oh, I think you might be talking about me. You who presume to be a teacher. Do you allow yourselves to be taught? Are you learning agile? Okay. Are you humble? Are you willing to be a good listener? You who say, don't commit adultery. Do you commit adultery? Or you do? Or you who murder? And so on and so forth. This sounds to me very similar back to the Sermon on the Mount. This is exactly what Jesus did in his exposition of the law. He said, look, you've heard that it was said, and that was a recurrent refrain in there. You have heard that it was said, don't commit adultery. And don't commit adultery. But I'm here to tell you that when you lust after a person in your heart, you've already committed adultery. You have heard that it was said, don't commit murder. But you know what? When you harbor anger and bitterness towards someone, that is not categorically different. It is part of the root of the same sin. He's not saying they're equally egregious, okay? But he's saying they're both of the same form of evil. And in some ways, it's the lust, it's the anger that is more insidious because we can hide it so well. The more religious we get, we learn the tricks of the trade. And he's saying, no. What you need is God's law to be like this high-tech camera that plunges the depths of the subterranean world of your life to show you what's really going on, the landscape of your heart, to shine the light into those dark places so that we can see what's going on. And he says here, he talks about, do you abhor idols? Are you going and robbing temples? Now that may have been happening literally, but it also harkens back to a constant theme in the Bible. You know, the first of the Ten Commandments is this point, you shall not have any other gods before me. And, we can carve gods and make them our gods, but fundamentally it's not talking about that. It's talking about what's going on in our heart, what we love, what we spend our time thinking about. When we have the opportunity to daydream, where do we go? And what are we really finding brings us relief in life? It's these kinds of things. And sometimes it's bad things, but oftentimes, you know, it's perfectly legitimate things that we've turned into ultimate things, like a relationship or our appearance or our career, our family, our resume, whatever it might be. It's taking the throne of our heart that was reserved exclusively for God alone and putting God on the periphery and now placing this other allegiance in its place. And when we do that, turning things into ultimate things that shouldn't have that place in our life, we realize that we are functionally an unbeliever at that point. It's a radical thing to get your mind around. See, if you're a Christian tonight, he is pressing down hard upon us. He's letting us have it. Because he's saying, like in verse 29, and really it's a constant thread throughout the passage, it's not about the externals. Growing spiritually isn't about curbing the external behavior. He's not giving a license for external behavior to continue. But he's saying the real way of transformation works from the internal to the external. It starts in the inside of us and works outside. Jesus said elsewhere, this is Mark chapter 7, where He was also kind of pressing down upon the religious people around him. And he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. Are you depressed? All these evils come from inside and defile a person. That's where the real problem is. And he'll go on to say, look, you're really like someone who is very effective at cleaning the outside of a coffee mug. I mean, you've walked up to a countertop before and you've looked inside the coffee mug and, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, it hasn't been cleaned in days and there's all sorts of, you know, there's a chemistry project going on in there. Imagine drinking from that. He says, that's what it's like when you do this. You're cleaning the outside but not the inside. And a more poignant and chilling image, he said, when we do this, we're like whitewashed tombs. Think of that. Beautiful, vibrant, clean, shiny on the outside. Death on the inside. Who wants to live there? Religious pride, he's saying, is a deadly thing. And if we If we get our sense of goodness, if we think we know good by going through different religious rituals, exercises, doing things externally while ignoring things or pretending things aren't so internally, what happens is we're playing games with God, and we begin to look down our nose at other people who haven't, quote, arrived as we have, when, of course, we're the ones who are playing the part of the fool because we're whitewashed tombs. This kind of playing games with God, this is a malady. It's been a strategy from the ancient times. The first humans, you know, they were in this place of spectacular paradise and freedom. You're free to eat from any of the trees before you, just not this one. What was that one? It's kind of interesting and curious. It was the tree of the knowledge of good and the converse, evil. And they just couldn't stand it. They had to have it. See, they knew good, and they certainly could have known good without eating of that tree, because we know good through God. But they said, God, I want to keep you at arm's length. I've got to know this. I've got to have this. I've got to have this fruit. And of course, when they ate of that fruit, everything exploded. Their relationship of life is their relationship with God was catastrophic, and with one another. They ran and hid, which is what we typically do as well when the camera goes down to the subterraneous world, or someone else points out one of our flaws. And then the curse was struck against them. This means judgment. And what happened? They were cut off from the land of the living, in essence. They were taken out of the garden. Why? Because in the garden was the tree of life. This is where you have access to the fullness of life. And so they were banished. They were cut off from the garden to wander through life. And that leaves, I don't know, this is kind of depressing, isn't it? And it leaves you feeling that way. I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of us don't feel like our lives are lining up. I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of us feel so down. I'm not trying to say this is the reason for depression. I think it's extremely complex. It is a contributing dynamic. The famed psychiatrist Carl Menninger said this: the present world miasma, I just like saying that word, present world miasma and depression are partly the result of our self-induced conviction that since sin has ceased to be, only the neurotics need to be treated and the criminals punished. The rest may stand around and read newspapers or look at television. In other words, we create this category. Here are the really evil people. You know, here's Hitler and Pol Pot and those kinds of people. And the rest of us are over here. We're okay. He said, that is delusional. We wait from day to day for improvement expectantly, but not very hopefully. Therefore, I say that the consequence of my proposal, and his proposal, contrary to people like Freud, was that things like sin and guilt are real and need to be dealt with. The consequence of my proposal would not be more depression, but less. If the concept of personal responsibility and answerability for ourselves and for others were to return to common acceptance, hope then would return to the world with it. That's the idea. The reason why, as a Christian minister, I talk about sin isn't because I want to make you feel like you're a horrible person. It's because that is the root problem every single one of us have. It's universal. Whether we embrace the Bible or we don't, whether we're religious or irreligious, it's this insidious cancer inside of us. It's eating us alive. And if we pretend that it's not real, if we pretend like we don't have guilt and accountability before a God who, as Paul says here in verse 16, will come and there will be a judgment day and all those secrets of that subterraneous world will be exposed before him. If we don't believe that, we're living a facade. So deal with it. And then hope comes. So that's the foundation for knowing good. It's the impediment for knowing good. Now the secret for knowing good. What am I talking about there? Well, the secret for knowing good is that we need to be changed in the secret places. I mean, he says this will take place, this is verse 16, on the day when God judges people's secret thoughts, that's the subterranean world, through Jesus Christ. Now listen to what he says, as my gospel declares. You may know the word gospel means good news. How in the world is the judgment day, where not just our external behaviors, the big things, you know, everybody can see, but the thoughts, the attitudes of our hearts, we're going to be judged. How in the world can that be a good thing? because the day of judgment is also a day of judgment that's meted out upon Jesus for us, ultimately and finally. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, what he's saying is in that secret place, we need newness. We need to be made new. We need a new heart. We need, he says here, a circumcision of the heart. That's what Paul says in verse 29. Now, the Old Testament prophets, the Hebrew prophets, this was their clarion call regularly to God's people. This sign that you have that's supposed to mark you out as God's holy people, don't make a mockery of that. Circumcise your hearts. Make real internally what that external sign represents. Paul is saying the same thing here. Don't play these games with God. Don't just utter mumbo jumbo spiritually and think that it makes some difference. Deal with the interior person in the secret places. That's the secret to knowing good. And how do we do that? It's by being circumcised of our heart. How do we do that? Well, let's think for a second about what circumcision actually is. Now, I don't want you to think too long about what it is, but you know, it was given by God to Abraham. He said, "This is the sign of the covenant I'm making. I'm entering into a faithful love relationship that you do not deserve, that will be utterly permanent. I will download my love upon you. You can't do anything to change it." But part of a covenant, actually, is that we are obligated to complete allegiance to the one who is making the covenant with us. Complete obedience. We've got to keep the train of our life on the tracks of his will through and through. And, you know, the problem, of course, is that nobody held up to that. First people didn't. Abraham didn't. So why is it that, why is it that God can still have this kind of covenant relationship with people? Why isn't it we're all not just incinerated in a moment? Why is it that the day of judgment, when he judges the secret thoughts, can actually be a good day for us? It's because what Paul says in another letter to the New Testament church of Colossae, Colossians chapter 2, verse 11, Paul says something that's enigmatic. It needs to just become this huge idea for us, making sense of this. He says that Jesus was crucified for us. What do you mean? Jesus was crucified on the cross for us. See, when a covenant was made, something like circumcision, but this is true with any covenant, that sign was actually acting out the curse of judgment that we would receive if we did not remain faithful to the covenant promises. It symbolized the judgment. So the idea of circumcision is it's a bloody idea. It's messy. And it means that we would be cut off from, like Adam and Eve were, from the land of the living. We'd be shoved out of paradise, and we wouldn't have access to God or to the true tree of life. So Jesus, on the cross, when he spread out his arms and died, the prophet Isaiah said he was cut off from the land of the living. He was circumcised. And the bloodiness of it, the gore of it, the judgment of it was levied upon Jesus. And that's not all that Paul said in Colossians chapter 2. He said that in him, we were circumcised. This is a really mind-stretching thing because the Colossians were Gentiles. Gentiles who became Christians. They weren't circumcised. He says this isn't talking about external circumcision. This is circumcision of the heart. That when Jesus was crucified, when he took the hit of the curse for you, when he was cut off for you, he did that so that as you come to him by faith, you are included in him. You are connected to him. That's what Christianity is about. It's entering into the world that is Jesus Christ, the living, reigning King and Savior of the world, and being connected vitally to him. It's united to Jesus, being in him. In him, we are circumcised. And what that means is that Jesus kept the law perfectly. He's the only really committed Christian. He's the only really good person through and through. And yet, ironically, he was treated as a criminal. Because again, Jesus, though he never broke the law, allowed himself to be broken so that we who break the law regularly might be loved and accepted and included in him and made whole. That is the Christian gospel. That's why Paul says on that day of judgment, when of course it should send a lightning bolt of terror through every human being, he says, no, this is actually good news if you understand it. if you're included into Christ. When those secret thoughts are revealed, Jesus has already taken the hit for that. And you'll be loved and accepted. In fact, it's mind-blowing because he goes on to say the final phrase of the passage, that such a person's praise is not from other people, but from God. God is praising us. That seems so backwards, and it is. But he's now saying, I love you. I believe in you. You are the trophy of my grace. You are beautiful beyond measure. You're not a bad person. You're a glorious being because you're included in me. Now, when that secret becomes encrypted in our heart, you know what it does? It begins to change us in magnificent ways. It changes the way that we think of our flaws, our interior flaws. See, if I approach goodness, if I think that I get to know good by following certain rules and adjusting my external behavior, then, as we've been saying all along, I'm living a lie because this world inside is incongruent with that. But more than that, you know what it ends up doing? It ends up causing me to want to not be honest with other people. When someone comes to me and points out a flaw, because my sense of goodness is based on my reputation, my track record, rather than Jesus, then I'm going to try and defend myself. And, instead, when Jesus is my identity, when I say, no, I'm a lawbreaker, but I am loved and accepted through him, then that gives me the freedom to say, when someone points out one of my flaws, oh, you just saw the tip of the iceberg. Let's go down below the water. Because there's a freedom. I'm no longer struggling to be free. I am free to struggle. And it's a beautiful thing. That's where every single one of us is. So it helps us to approach our interior flaws in a much more healthy way. It tames my propensity toward perfectionism. When I think about the fact that when God looks at me included in his son Jesus, he's not shaking his head and saying, oh gosh, Leo screwed up again. No, he is praising me. That is so counterintuitive spiritually, isn't it? That's a beautiful thing. That's why we have to keep preaching the gospel to ourselves. It also changes the way we approach the flaws we see in other people. Because again, if I am trying to live this life of moral virtue, and that is my ticket to being accepted, then you know what I do? And this is so dysfunctional, but I've seen this over and over and over again in my own life and as a pastor over the years, that I tend to look down and judge people who are struggling with the same thing I am. I have no patience for it in them. It's somehow I'm projecting my own inner anger at my inability to clean up my life, and I'm projecting it on someone else. However, if, again, the gospel is the gospel, and those secrets are actually liberating because it's magnifying God's grace, then I'm free. I'm free to identify with people who are flawed because I'm a flawed person just like them. And in some ways, even unbelievers may be much more virtuous in many areas of their life than I am. There's a freedom in that. It also changes the way that we approach the Bible, and this is the last thing that I'll say. See, instead of approaching the Bible as, it's like this law. I mean, as soon as I say the word law, I'm sure a lot of you just, it's not one of those words that you just go, yes, because the law seems to say this is what you can't do. And as soon as someone tells us we can't do something, there's something in us that says, but I want to do that. The Bible is first that. It is that mirror that shows us the true nature of our heart. And we need the law to run after us and tackle us and pin us to the ground. In fact, Martin Luther, as he was training his students who would be ministers, he said, look, don't do this. Don't preach the gospel. Excuse me. Don't preach the law as a manageable burden to people. Then they'll just do sin management. Instead, preach the law to kill. Let it pin them to the ground and not let them up until they call uncle, cry uncle of the gospel. Why? Because we need to read the Bible and we need it to read us. We need to look at the Bible, but we need ultimately to look through the Bible to the one who fulfilled the Bible. Jesus, at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, before he talked about any particular area of misalignment, he said this, look, I have come to fulfill the law. I have come to fulfill the law. And what he meant by that is the law is designed to take us to the place where we see we need him. We need someone to rescue us. We don't need a consultant spiritually. We don't need someone who can simply help us get up off the mat. We need someone who can save us. That's the idea of salvation. It means deliverance or rescuing. And that's what we need more than anything else in Jesus. And we know good because we know Jesus, the one who is ultimately good. So good that he gave his life for us. And look, this is all an approximation in this life. But one day, the great hope of the Bible, the great hope of our lives, is that we will pass through that day of judgment. And the good news is a whole world opens up for us. A world brimming over with magnificent goodness. Why? Because the excellencies of the one who is supremely good is there right in the middle of it. And we will be standing there together with a multitude beyond number, doing what he's doing to us, praising him and singing of his glory and greatness forevermore. Let's pray. Thank you, O Lord, that you love every single one of us. That you love us so much that you would take the essence of who you are, the law that points to you, to the lawgiver, and you'd place it in our hearts. You'd etch it there. Lord, some of us just don't want to believe that. Would you break through into our lives? Help us to embrace the one behind that sense of moral right and wrong. And to see that that impediment is it's nothing trivial. It's so great. It's like this cancer that we need to be rescued. We need the one who fulfilled the law to fulfill us and to lead us into a whole new way of knowing good. It's not about pasting on externals in our life, but about knowing it to the core of our being and being free to struggle in the process. And for those of us, Lord, who are committed to these things already, who are believers, oh Lord, strike us with the gracious blow of your gospel in Jesus, that he was cut off for us, that we might be included in him, that we might not be pretenders, but that we might be humble servants, so that people wouldn't disregard you and blaspheme you when they look at you, but they might see our lives and give glory to their Father who's in heaven. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.